memorizing the chanting for the ordination ceremony, that how I received this from my elders, Lopo Sumedho, Lopo Cha, and they received it from their elders, and they received it from their elders, and they received it from their elders, and we go all the way back to the Buddha. To me, you know, that was a, you know, I constantly reflect on that. It's extraordinary, this lineage of practitioners who have been doing this work in different cultural settings, and in some way it's effective, some way it's relevant, some way it works. It's really quite, it's like, it's amazing. So this is Theravada, way of the elders. And that's not just academic. It's not like simply preserving some kind of canonical rendition of Buddhism, but rather, to me, it's always been like hands-on. You know, it's like a carpenter teaching you how to use a plane, or how to make a nice knife edge, or how to use a chisel, or how to make a dovetail, whatever it might be. It's kind of really hands-on and pragmatic, rather than just a dogma or a theory that we believe, and it's maybe different than another theory that someone else believes. And so I've been very much trained in that kind of pragmatic way, and I'm sort of a practical guy, so it works for me. The reason I say this is I just read an article in one of those popular Buddhist, American Buddhist magazines about psychedelic Buddhism. And for those of you who are my age, you know you've tried that already. But what was interesting was a kind of, oh, this is the cutting edge. You know, now this is real Buddhism, or this is new Buddhism, or this is cutting edge. And one of the throw-off comments that was there is like, the baby boomers have had their chance. You know, so that's us. Like, we're kind of, but actually we're the elders. You know, we've held traditions of morality and social responsibility and meditation, so we are the elders. And that's not a conceit, it's a truth, isn't it? And I found that kind of disappointing in the article, that like, throw away the baby boomers, because there's, you know, it's old Buddhism, you know, it's not the new age Buddhism. And the kind of, what was in the article, it was a kind of self-importance. You know, we're really doing the thing. Good luck. Been there, done that. So what we're taking is a very old tradition, a very old tradition, and we're trying to make it relevant to our own present situation. Not only culturally, socially, but also our own minds, and it does work. It does work. And that's why we keep coming back to Arun Prior, because I think it is effective. So I always find it good just to go back to first principles. We will take the precepts, but just why do we do all this? So the Buddha is the Bodhisattva, the Siddharth. This Amarasiri's name was Siddharth. That was his name as a, that's what his mom gave him. And she, well, what did you expect? What else are you going to get? So Siddhartha is a seeker and all that, and he through his meditation, through his inquiry, he realizes something very, very profound, and then he couches it in two ways. One of the ways, he says, there's the uncreated, the unconditioned, the unoriginated, the deathless, Nibbana, peace. So he says, there is that, right? And that's an important statement for me, because it's not just a statement about better emotions. It's not just a statement about kind of being more simpatico with other people. It's much more profound than that, much more profound. So you could say it's a religious statement, or a transcendent statement, or a realization statement, whatever language works for you. But it's a profound realization. Otherwise, like the Buddha wasn't just a psychologist or a meditator. He was a realized being. And So then, from that, there's a decision to teach. And how does he teach? He points to that, but he points that the way to do this is actually to look at the very human predicament of suffering, that we all suffer, and we want to get out of suffering, we want to be happy. How do you do it? So rather than pointing to trying to get happiness as an object, he says, let go of suffering. And that's important to remember how Theravada works. And then he lays out the cause, the attachment to craving, and the abandonment of craving, non-desire, and then the path. So all Buddhist teachings in Theravada should fall within that. So any psychology we use, or any mindfulness techniques, or social justice issues and all that, should be able to fall within that simple background. And that's, I think, very important to remember, for me at least, that there is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, and the way to that is non-desire. And yet when you hear some profound transcendent possibility, then quite often you want to get it. So it's a paradox. Not a paradox, it's a kind of, I want to get that peace, and I get it through non-desire. It's very hard, actually. It's very hard to practice non-desire. Try it for half a minute. It's very hard, you know, because the mind's always doing something and creating something. So non-desire, or the abandoning of desire. And then, laying out the path, he says, well, how to do this? Well, try to live a good life. Try to live a life of generosity. And one of the ways he defines generosity is through the precepts. He says that the most generous thing you can do for a human being is to not kill them. And then they have freedom from fear of being killed. It's a generous action. And not to take their goods, not to steal their goods or whatever. And that gives them the freedom from fear from loss. And not to be promiscuous. And that gives them freedom in relationship, freedom from fear in relationship. And not to gossip and lie about them, because that gives them freedom from that kind of fear. And not to be stoned and drunk, because that just makes their life more pleasant. Quite simply. So the tone of Buddhist morality is through generosity rather than fear and punishment. There's a very, very different kind of tone from the Abrahamic traditions that we've come through. You know, there's moral action, and there's... Now, certainly in Buddhism, you get heavens and hells and all that kind of stuff that you hear. I can't relate to those very well. But I can relate to that. It's a very generous thing to not threaten someone, to not gossip. It's a very beautiful thing to do, isn't it? So the idea of beauty and goodness, and then generosity itself, like in the way we relate to each other. So that's this kind of, in a nutshell, it's part of the social construct of Buddhism. And then on a retreat, we, as you all know, remember the eight precepts, how we're going to live together. And we do that formally, make a formal declaration of that. And that's the use of ritual and intention. And I'm very fortunate to have taken up Buddhism in Thailand, where ritual is very much a part of the tradition. And just that's the way I learned it from my elders. And of course I find that, great, come, a retreat, come. We've been doing this together, and we do the chanting, just like that. And I remember when we first started in Quaker House, it was me and Anne, I think, were chanting, and everyone else was kind of watching, what are these guys doing? And then little by little, people get past their shyness and their reluctance, and maybe they even try bowing, doing a back exercise, and all of a sudden here, 30 years later, we just naturally doing a ritual which reminds us of our aspiration, which reminds us of the Buddha's teaching and whatever insights we've had. And that's so we come together as a Sangha through ritual in a way. It's really beautiful. It's not intellectual. And I really kind of love that feeling now. I come into this room and most of us know the chanting. No big deal. So the ritual of the eight precepts... And just to, an aside to that, you know, we've had several, I've been a part of several kind of caring situations this past year. Three people have died that I've gone to hospice and hung out with them as they're dying. And they ask me, so how do I do dying? It's the kind of question I get asked. How do you do dying? Yeah, it's an interesting question. Because the doctors say, how are you going to keep it going? How do you do dying? And we all have to answer that. But I did find in all these situations, because these people had a connection to our rituals, the chanting was incredibly helpful. I would just go in and I'd see someone kind of stressed with the pain or whatever, and I'd just do the chanting. Amar Sir was with me a lot on some of these occasions, and you just see the whole psyche just calm down. And that's the wealth of a life lived in I think significant ritual, not superstition, obviously. I don't think we'd go there. And it's a kind of something I didn't think of when I started this as a monk, but yeah, it's really quite lovely, quite profound. So the precepts themselves are ways of reminding ourselves of the way we want to live together, and to give our life a constant direction towards goodness, towards restraint, towards compassion and caring for others. And as you know, the ritual starts with homage to the Buddha and Namo Tassa, which we finish this. So homage to the Buddha for me is homage to the great teacher. It's very personal in that sense. Like Ajahn Sucitto was an interesting reflection he gave the other night. Ajahn Sucitto has been staying with us, which has been wonderful. He was saying how you think like the time of the Buddha, all these ascetics in India, they're really tough people. If you go to India and you see some of these ascetics, you know, how do they do it? They look crazy, some of them, and wild, but they're really, really tough and strong people. And the Buddha manages to take his first five disciples and he creates an order. He tames them into being able to take care of their robes, take care of each other, into a real kind of refined sangha of men doing spiritual practice. What a being. And it was a really lovely reflection from Ajahn Sucitto. Who was this being? And that philosophically, psychologically, he had it sus. You know, what was England doing 2,600 years ago? You got angry at me, bonk. You know, something like that. The subtlety of discussion, of philosophical discussion that was going on in India at that time. It's astounding. Just absolutely astounding what was going on. The levels of meditative attainment that people were attaining. You think about it, right? And these aren't myths. These are like they're described in text, the great beings Anuruddha or Sariputta or Moggallana, Mahamoggallana, all these great beings were there 2,600 years ago. And so when I reflect on Namo Tassa, I really try to bring that up into my mind, because that, for me, then brings forth a sense of deep, deep gratitude, and I think deep, deep possibility that the Buddha's enlightenment and his teaching then is saying, you know, beings who have but little dust in their eyes have a chance to do this too. We can realize profound things. We can live in profoundly compassionate ways, which is really, because humanity's got a pretty bad rap right now, you know. It's fair enough, you know, it's got to justify it maybe, but also humanity has this deep possibility. So the Buddha is a one who realized this, is emblematic, symbolic of that. So when I chant Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa, that's what I bring to mind. You bring to mind what you want, but this is a way of enlivening that sense of devotion and awe that we can, which is, I think, a spiritual impulse, a religious impulse. And then the other, the refuges, which we always do in Theravada Buddhism, we always do these same rituals again and again, nothing fancy, You know, we don't. You think, yeah, well, let's do a new one, right? Let's do the five refuges and the 608 precepts or something. No, we don't want to do the 608. No, we don't want to do that. We don't do, we just do the same thing. And it has a powerful effect. But refuge in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, Tisarana, the name of the monastery. Sarana is refuge. So here, I use the word Buddha here in the sense of awake. And that's kind of etymological meaning, awake, a meaning knowing what's going on, simple, knowing what's going on. And that is a possibility, it's very close to us. That's not far from any moment, actually. It's always a possibility here and now. And I obviously talk a lot about that. So when I'm just sit here and I know the that's awake. And I can't describe it. I can say it's hot, it's cold, but that's all you can say about it. Nothing. It's just awake. And we all know that, don't we? So there's nothing. It's not something you have to find. It's just to remember. Just wake up. Whoop. And it's not just about nodding. You know, it's more profound than that. It's that the mind which really knows what's going on right now. And Dharma? What's Dharma? Well, Dharma's the way it is now. Hot, cold, happy, sad. So like if I was diagnosed with terminal cancer tomorrow, and then the Dharma of that would be I might be upset. You know, wait a minute, I still got some woodwork to do. I want to make that table. Whatever, and that would be the Dharma of getting a very, very frightening diagnosis. You could say to me, oh, Viradhamma, I mean, you've been a monk for 45 years, you should be cool. I don't know. I don't know what I'll be, because I'm nothing, really. These things just arise and pass. So part of Dharma is causality. With this as condition that arises, this being that comes to be. And we can see that. We can see that flow of life. So I get, you know, I get some good news, some bad news. Maybe I react, maybe I don't know. But the very way it is, the very kind of causality of it is Dharma. And you can't really name that either. But you can have things which point to it. Yeah? And the particular Dharma that we're observing and considering is the end of suffering. That's a particular Dharma that we're concerned with, obviously. And so there are other dharmas, other things. So the teachings don't describe everything. They don't describe capitalism or they don't talk a lot about social justice issues. They're very vague on that. So there's a lot of things that the written dharma doesn't describe. But that's not what it's meant for. It's not meant for everything. It's not meant to cover everything. It's meant really for the liberation from suffering. And then Sangha is the community which lives by these principles. And that which in us, which lives by those principles. So that which in me, which is moral, which is aspiring to Nibbana, and that group of people who encourage me in that is a way of looking at Sangha. So Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, the three refuges. Perfect package. That's a perfect social package. And the rest, well, yeah, we need other things. We need laws and so on, but it's the perfect spiritual package, I would say. Awake to the way things are, living in communion within myself and others in a way which is socially and morally good and harmonious, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So that's the refuges. And again, we do that again. I give the same talk each retreat and so on and so forth. But I think it's worth remembering. And then we could perhaps turn to the precepts and look at that. I'll explain them. And you got that? Thank you. So why don't we look at 130? The eight precepts. So I undertake the precept on page at 134. I'm sorry, 134. So I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. Ajahn Jayasaro gave a lovely talk at the opening of the Dharma Hall in Abhayagiri on this, and it was really, really, really inspiring. It's probably on, I think it's on YouTube. But he was saying how he was talking more about like in relationship, that first priest said, like, I promise you that you might get up my nose and I might really, really dislike you, but I will not hurt you. I make you that promise. I promise you I will not hurt you. It's a nice way to put it. And then the second precept, I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. You might really like my clock. It's an admirable clock. It's a great clock. And you might really, 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 really want it. But you promise me you will not take my clock. Right? And that's, I love the way he put that. And then the third precept, say, in lay life would be, in the five precepts, would be, you know, as much as I'm attracted to someone outside of this relationship, and as much as you just look like an old toad this morning, I promise you I will be faithful. I promise you I will be faithful. But he's really beautiful. I'm sure no one looks like an old toad in the morning. But in this... In this example, it's the third precept. I undertake the precept to refrain from any intentional sexual activity. So not pursuing the sexual energies and just observing them in a more passive way. I undertake the precept to refrain from lying or gossiping or tale-bearing. Again, as much as I would not like you to know what I did yesterday and the things I got up to, I will not lie to you. I promise you that. Huh? I promise you that. Suramerya, I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness. I promise you, even though I'm really spaced out, I won't go to drugs. I won't go to that venue and mess your life up by my intoxication. I promise you I won't do that. And then the Vikala Bhojana, these are different. These are simply... precepts of simplification. I undertake the precept to refrain from eating at inappropriate times. It's not a moral issue, so if someone has diabetes or hyperglycemia, please help yourselves to whatever you need. But it's just simplifying things. So, you know, we have certain meal times and we just keep it to that rather than, what's the word? Grazing. Grazing. It's a nice word. I haven't grazed for years. Don't have the opportunity. Nachagita, I undertake the precept to refrain from entertaining, beautification, and adornment. This is not immoral, nothing wrong with it. And I always like to tell a story of my mother when the hairdresser came. And I love this story, yeah, because I really remember it strongly. And he came and he did her hair. She was so happy. She felt clean. She felt proper. She's a proper woman, very kind of dignified. And it was a beautiful thing for her. So it's adornment. So there's nothing wrong with it. She didn't dress like Lady Gaga, that was sure. Good taste. And entertainment, there's nothing wrong with entertainment. It is as it is, but like to actually do without your cell phone or all of that business for a few days, it's quite good to watch because it doesn't excite the mind, you know, you don't get excited and it just calms the mind down. So entertainments can be useful, but they can also be very distracting. And then the eighth precept, I undertake the precept to refrain from lying in a high and luxurious sleeping place, which is rather weird, and people say, what's that one about? And that's just basically, you know, in a time of India, if you had a high and luxurious sleeping place, you'd be doing very well. And it's the idea of indulging in luxurious comforts and you just get lazy, basically. So it's not like, not just... zoning out in the sleep zone, taking that what we call the fourth refuge, sleep. Okay, so it's moderation and sleep. So you most of you know these precepts, and we have a formal way of doing that. So if we could go back to page 131. So I'll just read it out for you to help you do this, but if usually it's custom, if you want to bow three times first. So if anyone would like to do that, to bow three times in taking the precepts, please do that. And then I'll lead you in the Pali to help you along. Okay. So on top of 131, for a group from a monk. I'll read out the Pali words word by word, and if you follow me, then it'll help you remember the form. So, Mayang Bhante Tisaranena Sahaata Silani Yajama Dutiyampi Mayang Bhante Tisaranena Sahaata Silani Yajama Tatiyampi Mayang Bhante Tisaranena Sahaata Silani Yajama. And flip over the page. And so I'll do the Namo Tassa three times, and then you follow me after my three times. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tisaranagamanang nititang. You say Ama Bhante. And then the precepts, I'll do the Pali word by word and then English in one line. Panatipata Veramani Sikapadang Samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. Adinadana Veramani Sikapadang Samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. Abrahmacharya Veramani Sikapadang Samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from any intentional sexual activity. Musawada Viramani Sikapadang Samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from lying. Suramereya Maja Pamadatana Veramani Sikapadang Samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness. Vikala Bhojana Veramani Sikapadang Samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from eating at inappropriate times. Nacha Gita Vadita Visukhadasana. Mala Ganda. Vilepana. Dharana. Mandana. Vipusanatana. Veramani. Sikapadang. Samatiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from entertainment, beautification, and adornment. Uchasayana. Mahasayana. Veramani. Sikapadang. Samatiyami. And I take the precept to refrain from lying on a high or luxurious sleeping place. Imani, atta, sikapadani, samadhiyami. Imani, atta, sikapadani, samadhiyami. Imani, atta, sikapadani, samadhiyami. Silena sukating yanti, silena boga sampata, silena niputting yanti tasama, silang visotaye. Sato, sato, sato. There you go. We get that sato going right from the first day. Okay, so that, it's a good reminder, isn't it? Sets you up. Well, what we're doing really is we're making determinations. We're determining, making intentions of how we're going to live our life and what we're going to be doing. And intention is always very, very important. It's something you have to constantly cultivate in all aspects of life, because that's what makes you mindful around that which is important. If you're heedless, then you're also kind of making intentions, but they're not done from skill, they're not done from wisdom, and they have results too, right? So if I inadvertently decide I'm going to hate someone and just dwell in that hatred, that's intention. And then I have a whole bunch of baggage which I have to sort out later on. So intention is very important. That's what we've done. And that's why we do this kind of three times thing in Buddhism. It's like, yes, 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 I'm going to do this. That's the idea. And the precept on speech, again, the retreat is done in noble silence. So do try to use this time, because it's very precious, very rare that you get a chance not to have to relate socially. You can smile, you can pass the ketchup, that's allowed, but just be with yourself and try not to pull other people into talking, because quite often people will be polite, but really they really don't want to go there. And then if you have questions, please do ask me. We'll have a bowl maybe with the paper, and people can write questions. Any housekeeping things? Jane, are you? Who's the person?
Carl and I are Carl? Retreat managers, but we've already gone over.
Okay, if people have questions about that, they can come to you later on. Yep.
And
they got a noteboard. Yeah. Okay, so that's that would do that. What else? Well, you've been sitting here for a long, long time. It's probably enough, huh? How about we finish with a bit of chanting? Let's see what we got. How about 40-41? Let's see if that... 40-41? It's 40. Let me change my mind here. Now let's do 43. These are the four boundless qualities shine. Four boundless qualities are that. That's how in Theravada we define divinity. So it's something. Something of the heart. So we'll do that in English, okay? I will abide pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a heart imbued with loving-kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with compassion, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a heart imbued with compassion, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with gladness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a heart imbued with gladness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a heart imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And we'll finish with a closing hum. What time do we start? This, yeah. Seven?
Six. Oh, six.
Oh. Let's start with a breath. You guys are getting slack. Is there a schedule around? Can I get one later?
I was thinking we should give you a schedule. Great. There are some posted.
It's good if I showed up.
But yeah, it's important.
So, page 16, we do the closing homage.
So completely explained by him, Dhammam namasami, I bow to the Dhamma.
Supatipanno
Bhagavato Savakasangho, the Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well, Sangham Namami, I bow to the Sangha.
That's a beautiful Buddha, isn't it? So elegant. Even though I say so myself.